Blog Talk Radio.
Radio and the Cosmic Citizen. My name is Paula Thompson. I'm your host, and with me are my dear friends and co-hosts, Chuck Thurston, Marvin Gowron, and Andre Rodatis. Hi, you guys.
Hey, Paula.
Hey,
hey
Paula. Paula.
Hey. We're all here. Yay.
Everybody.
I'm so glad, because this is a new study. It's going to be a great paper, paper 55. The Spheres of Light and Life. And I have a question for you guys about that, but I wanted to ask you if, Marvin and Andre, did you attend, and you too, Chuck, did you attend Barry Bedell's memorial last weekend?
Yes, I did.
Yeah, I think Andre and I were there, yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I bet it was really sweet.
It was Elizabeth Callahan and Maureen Amato-Mays officiated, and
great.
It was nice. It was a good Zoom event. It was wonderful seeing the Bedell family. It was wonderful seeing Jeff Bedell, Sally Annabella, the whole, you know, Bedell clan, and just to hear stories about, you know, Barry, but also the clan. I expressed at the end, you know, wish I could be a Bedell. You know, they're nice. They're a really wonderful clan, wonderful group of people. You can tell, you know, just very personable folks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was quite a range. Yeah. And what I think Andre was about a third, maybe third to a half of the Bedell family, and then a third to a half, you know, two thirds for about. Folks from just all around the movement who knew Barry and shared with him during the lifetime we've been here together. So it was quite a lot sharing. Yeah. And he was a wonderful human being. I think, well, man, we're all wonderful human beings, but it was really a treat to celebrate him and his qualities and kind of what he brought into people's lives. Memorial services are just, they're quite an interesting phenomenon as a social occasion. Yeah, and it was wonderful.
From a Urantia perspective, they really are, and especially in an instance where someone like Barry lived such a long and full life, there's really no tinge of sorrow there. You know, you'll miss that person, but it's like, well, they were ready to go. It's like our dear friend Don Green who said, well, I got my ticket punched, and I am on my way. You know, and he had such a positive, wonderful attitude about dying that all the doctors and nurses who were taking care of him were just astonished. They couldn't get over it. You know, everybody wasn't all morose and just, you know, depressed we'd go to visit Don and we were all cheerful and he had such a great attitude, and I know Barry was just the same, and it's a gift of having the knowledge we've been given and having it in such a way that it just helps you so firmly know and believe that this is just the beginning, this life, and that there's truly is an endless voyage of adventure awaiting us.
Yeah.
So that's invaluable. You know, Urantia, you know, based Urantia, funerals based on the Urantia teachings are actually pretty sweet and positive and hopeful.
Yeah. I mean, there's still this loss.
Sort of life celebration.
There's still the loss of the individual, but it's mitigated by that joy. So, you know, there was a little bit of bittersweetness there, you know, but not much. You know, most people are glad for their departed more than they are sad for their loss, although the loss when one is alone is palpable, of course, and that's
it
to be
is.
Understood. You've just lost somebody you love, and they're no longer there to love or to be a source of love in your life. So that's all understandable.
Yeah.
It would
when
be a little
I,
bit weird, I think, if everybody was just unmitigatedly, you know, joyful. You know, God, I'm glad they're gone.
Well, the way I equate it to, like, going down to the dock to bid a loved one farewell on a long sea voyage over to a place like China where you know very well, you probably won't get to see them much in this life again, you know, and that would be very sad, you know, because we love each other and we need each other, you know, and people who are happy and joyful and you know, interesting and deeply involved and engaged in life like Barry, you know, it's sad to think of this life without them in it. You know, that's of course that would make you sad. But it's also greatly joyful to think of eternity with them in it, you know, and not only but all the others.
Go
ahead, Marvin.
all I had. That's also part of the context, you know, is, golly, you know, a very short time and we'll be making the same transition, the same journey and rejoining them and enjoying their company and forever.
Yeah.
And so it's, you know, there's that in the background too, that we're bound. We're mansion world bound, you know.
Right.
So that flavors our remembrances, our celebrations of life. I like that term. So what they, you know, celebration of a person's life. Yeah.
Right. That's pretty sweet. I was sorry to miss that, but I was in Mexico last week, which is great. You know, I was so glad to be there and have that opportunity to enjoy a little respite from the working world. It's a step out of reality, really, to go to Mexico to go to a resort, because they want you to have a good time and they want you to worry about a thing. And you know, it's really nice that way. But it's, you know, kind of off the grid too. So anyway, I'm glad you guys got to go. to Barry's memorial. Here's my question about our study coming up in the paper 55, the spheres of light and life. I want to ask you guys, I just want to throw it out there. What did that mean to you the first time you ever saw that term, light and life, and even, you know, the spheres of light and life? What did that term do for your heart when you saw it first and first encountered that concept?
You know, just speaking to that briefly, didn't know what to make of it at first, you know, just before studying it. But after studying it a little bit and just letting it sink in, clearly it's trying to convey the idea of the dynamic of life along with the illumination of mind, soul, spirit, all of that. But it's an interesting way to characterize. What struck me most about it was that they eschewed the term utopia, which is the way all of us, you know, what English human culture or human culture all over the world would have called it, you know, when you reach utopia. Well, they don't say that. They don't talk about reaching utopia. They talk about reaching the spheres of light and life. So that sets up a contrast. And immediately, I mean, the first thing that I think they are trying to do is disabuse us of the false notions of what a utopia is. I think they use the term perhaps once. I'll look it up here. You know, in a very limited fashion with regard to this, and mainly referring to the human conception of it. But that's all I have to say about it.
I would say for me, what struck me more was the idea of the era of light and life, that's a future state of affairs projected even for this world. So to have a goal of evolutionary destiny put forward as a positive concept that's not only reachable, but thoroughly supported and planned and expected, like it's going to happen. It's just a matter of how and when. But to have that, it's kind of like the book's teachings about the afterlife. You know, knowing that we go on and there's a destiny for us in the universe. It's kind of the same with the concept of the era of light and life in this world, that our planet has a destiny and that we can contribute to that even now, even though destiny is far, far away. We can still be actively engaged and, you know, moving it a millimeter closer just by virtue of our positive inputs and types of service we choose to do, anything that contributes to realization of higher values and manifestation of more coherence around spirit and God, all of that contributes to reaching that destiny. But just to have a concept of our world's destiny, even if we won't be here, just to have that mapped out conceptually and described, particularly as we're going to read here, I'm sure, in such specific terms, is very inspiring and very, you know, so you get your motivational juices worked up, knowing that we're not just floating in a sort of state of endless confusion, but there's real, even higher beings working with us to bring through and bring forward and make manifest this vision of our planet's destiny. And then how that ties in with the Supreme and everything else, and it takes that same concept and expands it out to the universe, or at least our local universe, our system, and eventually the whole, all of time and space. So that's such a grand and expansive, and wow, what a concept. You know, it just really stretches the mind as far as it can go to begin to try to grasp what they're really talking about here.
So true.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. Yeah, it's a great question, yeah. Paula. And I'm trying, you know, it's a long time ago now, but first encounter the term for all of us, really.
Yeah.
I think most of us have been reading the book such a long time. My thought is sort of related to, I think, what Chuck was sharing. And then I also looked up the word utopian while Andre was talking. That's really, really interesting. They use the word utopian very rarely in the book. Only four times does it come up. I didn't look up utopia, but they
it only comes
only
up once.
Utopia, yeah. They only use the word utopian. They say in such an age is the planetary threshold to the utopian ages of light and life. So that's in paper 72. But in paper 55, there's no use of the word utopian. I don't know if utopia shows up. But that's interesting, Andre. I hadn't thought about that.
It's only used outside of the paper.
Yeah, right.
Isn't that interesting?
they don't eschew it entirely, you know. They do hearken to it, but they're really trying to take us well beyond it because our ideas are so romanticized. They're trying to get us to the idea that, you know, this builds on culture. This builds on a spiritual culture that evolves over time, and that's why it's solid. You know, it's something that lasts. It's not something that can be here today and gone tomorrow.
Right.
Yeah.
It makes total sense, doesn't it?
There's this paragraph in paper 68. The modern phrase back to nature is a delusion of ignorance, a belief in the reality of the one-time fictitious golden age. The only basis for the legend of the Golden Age is the historic fact of Dalmatia and Eden. But these improved societies were far from the realization of utopian dreams. Yeah, so the utopian dreams is sort of like idyllic times when you can kick back and not do anything and, you know, everything's taken care of and everything's all bliss. Yeah. Just going back to your question, though, Paula, and this to me more relates to what Chuck was sharing about. I think you used the word destiny, Chuck. And it's sort of related to what we're talking about, I think, at the beginning of the show about, you know, here we are in this life and we go and celebrate a person's life and we think about what's coming next, kind of like where we're going. And it really helps to make sense of what we find ourselves in the middle of. And that's true on a global sense for me. When I first encountered the idea that this is going somewhere where all of the inconsistencies and really craziness of today's world, all of the intense problems and the seeming dilemmas and the hardships, the struggles, et cetera, are intended, you know, as part of the pathway toward a resolution and then a making of things right that we get to participate in. And that just felt so good and felt so right that it wasn't all for naught and it wasn't all just a ceaseless struggle, that it was all really going somewhere that was intentional and ideal in its own way. And orderly and you know, godlike. And the feeling that was true not only for, you know, sort of in relationship between this life and the next life and the eternal ascent, but it was also true for society in this world and where this world is eventually bound. It just felt so right, you know, is what I remember feeling like, oh, I'm so glad that is the case, you know, that it's going somewhere to a destiny that is intended and true and good and beautiful, all those high values.
Right.
The fourth reference in paper 74, I think, is also very interesting because it kind of speaks to the importance of what the book is giving us with this concept of light and life as a goal of destiny or a goal of achievement in contrast to what they're describing here. I could just read this paragraph quickly. This is paper 74, 813. In other words, your answer book concept of light and life kind of being an antidote to what they're describing in this paragraph, where they say that Christian teachers perpetuated the belief in the fiat creation of the human race. And all this led directly to the formation of the hypothesis of a one-time golden age of utopian bliss in the theory of the fall of man or Superman, which accounted for the non-utopian condition of society. These outlooks on life and man's place in the universe were at best discouraging, since they were predicated upon a belief in retrogression rather than progression, as well as implying a vengeful deity who had vented wrath upon the human race in retribution for the errors of certain one-time planetary administrators. But this flipping of the script from progression, retrogression versus progression, I think is so important because this, you know, this is still a part of Christian civilization in a big way. That's why there's all these issues about evolution. You know, when you hear Christians and atheists debate, this always comes up. You know, the fiat creation idea and all of that. So the, to be given this progressive evolutionary concept is so helpful, I think, because it's a way to kind of finally get free of this, you know, if you believe that, you know, a vengeful deity has trapped us in this pattern of retrogression and there's no way out, that's kind of a harsh concept of reality to try to
The only way out is through the atonement and, you know, the atonement doctrine, which is also fiat. It's a fiat resolution.
Yeah, right.
You know, it's like God just simply makes it happen, you know. Yeah.
Right.
Instead of a progressive evolutionary attainment that we accomplish, what is portrayed in the Ranch book. It's all evolutionary. And the destiny is out there sort of determined as the goal. But we get to be partners in its accomplishment and bringing it to be.
Yeah. Well, yeah, you know, I'm so glad you guys said all of that because I absolutely agree. And that I think, you know, all of those understandings are predicated on other things the book has taught us. And the very first thing it teaches us is that God is not angry, vengeful, wrathful, you know, mad at humanity, whatever you want.
Right.
You know, that's the big lie. That's the original big lie. And then they all kind of send out tendrils from there. But having grown up, for me, having grown up in the age of, and I know you guys will remember this, the specter of nuclear war, the specter of the devastation of World War II, and the fear of being bombed, duck and cover drills in grade school, you know, where you had to get under the table. The general belief, and I heard it said many times in my life as a young person, oh, humanity will never get over war. We'll never be able to get along. We will never. We're going to destroy ourselves. We are doomed. You know, I mean, that was pretty much what people said, even cavalierly, you know, glibly. Oh, yeah, we'll never learn to love each other. Oh, get over that. You know, boy, are you a pie-eyed optimist.
Remember the phrase? Going to hell in a handbasket, remember that?
Oh, yeah. We're going to hell in a handbasket, you know. And you still hear those things. You still hear that obsession. I will say that it's an obsession with darkness and death.
Not the darkness and death happen.
They do, but it's like we believe that that's all we get.
Right,
you know,
right.
And how many times have you heard these sayings, you know, you only go around once, so go for the gusto. And, you know, life's a bitch and then you die, things like that, you know, where there's just no hope, none.
Yeah. You're a fluke
no hope
of the universe,
for humanity. Yeah, you're a cosmic accident. And then you here comes this book that spells out what Marvin was saying, a purpose to all of this, and all of you actually, there's a purpose and a meaning for all of this struggle, and it's going somewhere. And you will get there. And yes, it's hard. That's okay. It's hard by design, you know. But you will get to this place that the authors call light and life. And what a beautiful, you know, how that fills you with whimsy and imagination of what that must be like.
Yeah.
For the world to be lit up by the love, by the love of the Creator, the love for the Creator, the love of the Creator coming through us to each other, our love and service for each other, a true brotherhood of mankind. And like John Lennon said, imagine that. You know, can you imagine that? And I always appreciate it, even though I don't agree with all the lyrics of that song, obviously. I appreciate that he was asking people to imagine that the things that divide us can, you know, cannot be so important. And the things that unite us can be more important. And so the era of light and life and the age of light and life was such a relief for me, such a monumental relief to think, not only do I get to go on, not only does my life have purpose and value and the potential of eternity, the world's life does too. Humanity does have that potential. Our world has that potential. Our children will inherit that. Our children's children's children will, you know, as the book says, be as a chosen generation, I think is how it puts it. That, you know, though they don't have to struggle anymore, it'll be very clear the shoulders they stand on, you know. And so what amazingly wonderful news that is. I just think I've never heard better news. Here's what the book says about those children in the age of light and life. This is from paper 52, the Planetary Mortal Epics, 52.7.13. It is the mortals of such an age who are described as a, quote, chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, an exalted people, and you shall show forth the praises of him who has called you out of darkness into this marvelous light. And that's all in quotes. Must be a biblical quote, right?
That's lovely.
So, that's lovely, hopeful, Paul. Right? Doesn't that just give you hope for humankind that no matter how grave seem our challenges, we can make it? And I, you know, I just started rereading yesterday Government on a Neighboring Planet. Just felt compelled to read that again and try to really fully understand what they are implying in the many things that they give us, the example of a neighboring planet, interestingly, a planet not far from us, a planet in the same system, not the same solar system maybe, but the same system, and one that has had similar challenges, a defaulted planetary, you know, atom, and, you know, in rebellion. And this particular government has been able to achieve. And the thing that really stood out to me yesterday as I was reading it is they give you a time frame in there a lot. They say, well, you know, this has been in this particular policy they enacted has been going on for about 75 years, and it's really starting now to make a difference. So it gives you a sense of how long it might take to implement some of these systematic changes that would really start our planetary culture moving in a right direction. It's really interesting to take all of these papers, these amazing papers about planetary destiny and about, you know, evolution on a planetary scale, and just kind of take them and hold them together.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah,
as a whole, what they're saying to us.
Yeah, and I think it's also important to keep these other planetary mortal epics in mind that intervene,
yes,
between where we are now and the future era of light and life. It's not like we can just skip to light and life, like, or within,
yeah,
within any short period of time. I mean, we still have to go through. I mean, we're still kind of sort of in the material comfort era, sort of not, you know. And then there's I don't have that up in front of me, but there's at least two or three epics that we have to master as a planetary civilization before we stand,
right,
on the threshold of light and life. So,
right.
I mean,
yeah,
that's sobering,
it's pretty,
but
abundantly.
It also gives us a way forward conceptually. You can,
right,
see that. We need a philosophic age, you know, where quality of thinking becomes the new standard of living, right? That's kind of in,
right,
the next era or stage.
Right.
And then beyond that, there's all kinds of spiritual development that has to take place with these, well, we're going to read about it in this paper, but... you know, post-teacher sons, magisterial sons, all of that. We have a lot to look forward to along the way. But I noticed that,
right,
some people think, oh, well, we'll be enlightened life next year. All we have to do is this and that. No, I don't think so.
You,
I mean,
know,
it's protected,
yeah,
out, I think. Hundreds of thousands.
You know, the other,
yeah,
the other, I think the other set of factors that comes to mind when we talk about all this stuff is just what a mixture, you know, we sort of have our feet in so many different planetary epics on this world because of the chaos of the two defaults, you know, the planetary rebellion, the planetary prince rebellion, and then the default, that it's really confusing quite where we are. And unlike, I've thought about this too a little bit, you know, unlike the neighboring planet where you have this one nation that's far in advance of any of the others, we're sort of all over the place, and there isn't a sense of how separate one society is from another. There's a lot of interaction and a lot of mixture, and
mm-hmm.
That's part of what's challenging, I think, about our world is how confusing, and the word polyglot comes to mind. You know, it's just like all these parts of different planetary mortal epics playing out in different parts of our world.
Yeah, we're spread across several of them, it seems.
Yes.
Yeah.
We,
yeah,
are. Still,
well,
tribal
security,
in some instances.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. You know, all the way up to, you know, very progressive, you know, ways of being. So it's interesting.
I just found this. I get to read the list of these epics. I mean, the first,
mm-hmm,
is the nutrition epic, then the security age. And we're a large portion of the planet, I think, is still in that period. Then,
mm-hmm,
the material comfort era. And following that is the quest for knowledge and wisdom. Then comes the epic of philosophy and brotherhood, followed by the age of spiritual striving. That's number six. Then that leads into the era of light and life, which is number seven.
Yeah. So
yeah,
you
let me just remind you guys, as a technical note, we have one listener, I'm sure, that I know of, that would love to know the citations.
Yeah,
and
I was just going to
okay.
add that.
If you don't give the citations, Arvilla is going to reach her hand.
I know,
right,
I know.
Through the radio.
I can hear it. I can feel it.
So make sure you give those citations.
Okay.
That's 55.
No, that's...
Yeah.
What's that?
50.5.
Paper 50, section 5, yeah.
Section 5 from 50. 4, paragraphs 4 through 10.
Yep.
We're not forgetting you, Arvilla.
I was just going to add that.
I was just now going to add that. Well, yeah, it's really wonderful to contemplate where we are, and that and here's the other side of it too for me, and it's something that just spreads throughout the whole book. Is, you know, as you read it, as you resonate with the intellect of it, with the love that comes through it. It's a very much, there's a quality of love that comes through the Urantia book that's very parental. It's very big brotherly, let's say, or big sisterly. You know, we have some information to impart. We want to give this to you because we know it's going to help. This is what you need. May not be what you want to hear necessarily, but it's what you need to hear. And the most interesting thing about it is how good the news is. You know, we're almost so jaded we can't, well, no, that's not, no, God is that loving, and, you know, there's not a purpose for humanity where, you know, that's nonsense. Why on earth would we ever believe that? But it has a way of just taking those jaded, skeptical, you know, misguided opinions away from you and setting your feet firmly on the path to the future and to the purpose of life. And it does that throughout the whole book in the most amazing and beautiful way. And to where you really start to understand how much you are loved and valued by the universe. And whatever challenges we have, you know, how much faith they have in us to overcome these challenges. And the thing that's amazing to me is to think how many worlds of like ours they've seen evolve and how many beings like us they've seen grow and get there. And they're just so certain we will make it because we will. They wouldn't have it any other way.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where we need to we can fully trust in that we will get there if we will but just open ourselves up to these possibilities and not always think of progress as being impossible.
Yeah. It is, you know, conceivable that in little tiny pockets or in individual lives you can begin to touch some of the values associated with the era of light and life. I think this paper 50, section 5, paragraph 10, which is the little short paragraph describing the era of light and life in that list of epics, I think it might be a good lead-in to what we're about to read because it gives an interesting summary. I'll just read this. It says,
good segue.
50,
what's the citation
5,
again?
Yeah.
Sorry.
55, 10.
Paragraph 10, and it's titled The Era of Light and Life, which is the seventh epic, says, this is the flowering of the successive ages of physical security. They're almost just reviewing those previous ages. The successive ages of physical security, intellectual expansion, social culture, and spiritual achievement. These human accomplishments are now blended, associated, and coordinated in cosmic unity and unselfish service. Within the limitations of finite nature and material endowments, there are no bounds set upon the possibilities of evolutionary attainment by the advancing generations who successfully live upon these supernal and settled worlds of time and space.
Mm.
So that list of physical security, intellectual expansion, social culture, and spiritual achievement, those all have to reach a flowering, they say.
Right.
Which will lead into their blending and association and coordination and cosmic unity and unselfish service, which will carry then characterize the era of light and life.
Right.
And then the fact that they put no limitations on what can be then achieved going forward from there is also just very intriguing to contemplate, especially if we start to imagine the beginning of the inhabitants of the, you know, the habitation of the outer space levels and all these outer spacers who are going to come tracing through our world on their way into Havana.
Well, it's amazing as well to contemplate, you know, the what unlimited kinds of things might happen if we actually read the paper.
Yes, and that's paper 55, but I want to add one more cross-reference before we start with paper 55, and this is from paper 52, section 6, paragraph 8, and 52, of course, is the planetary mortal epochs. If you could be transplanted from your backward and confused world to some normal planet now in the post-bestowal sun age, you would think you had been translated to the heaven of your traditions. You would hardly believe that you were observing the normal evolutionary workings of a mortal sphere of human habitation. These worlds are in the circuits of their realm, and they enjoy all the advantages of the universe broadcasts and the reflectivity services of the super universe. I always love that because we have a concept of the heaven of our traditions, and it's actually our future life on this very world. And that's pretty amazing.
you know the last thing the last sentence you read there, Paula, and that's really a sweet section. Just what you read. I mean, the image I had is, you know, what we take for granted because we are purveyors of this revelation, meaning that we're part of something much larger and meaningful and purposeful that's going somewhere. It's going toward God and the centrality of our relationship with God, the part that plays in all of it. What they're saying is by being hooked up or connected with all of these broadcasts and reflectivity circuits, and who knows what the implications of all that would be like as it played out in a planetary culture. But at the very least, everybody on the planet would take as background assumptions the things that we have in this revelation, right? That the universe is populated,
right.
That God exists, that there's an eternal ascent of progress toward God. That's all of our destinies, and we're all part of something much larger. That the implication is that would pervade the global culture. Can you imagine? I mean, can you imagine living in a society where everyone understood that, and that was the common background of all the interactions? That alone is astounding. You know, as a difference, and they're not talking about light and life. They're talking about a post-bestowal sun age, which is the one technically that we're in. So, you know, you could see where it's so different if everyone functioned with those assumptions. You know,
it's
the people
like,
in the people in the grocery store. You know, I mean, just
It reminds me of what we all experience when we get together, right? I mean, we fully understand these basic assumptions, and so we proceed as though we know this is true, and because we do. And so we have a conference or a retreat or a gathering, even this, you know, weekly show, this weekly broadcast, and it's a little slice of light and life.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, it speaks to the importance of carrying those accomplishments forward from one generation to the next so they're not lost. And that's where, of course, the family comes in and also, you know, all of our social associations and all of that. But especially the family, I mean, the book talks about that. The culture is really passed on through the family and the neighborhood and the schools and everything else. But that's why strong families
with the
are,
family.
So important, are so important. Because even though what you're describing there, Marvin, it can be achieved within a small circle. In order for that to grow and inspire a greater section of the population, it has to be preserved. It has to survive. It has to be carried forward from one generation to the next. And that's, you know, obviously what we're all trying to do. But just that process of continuity from generation to generation is so critical, because things can be lost in a single generation so easily on a world like this.
That's so true. Well,
then
there's also the
question that I know is lurking somewhere in the back of Andre's mind, and that is, will we get to read this paper during this current universe age?
This universe age, yeah, right. That's an important ballpark.
I like that not so subtle a segue, Marvin.
Yeah, great.
So let's start this. Let's light this candle. Paper 55, The Spheres of Light and Life. I'll start if you guys don't mind, and then we can go.
Yeah,
through.
Go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah, go.
Okay. The age of light and life is the final evolutionary attainment of a world of time and space. From the early times of primitive man, such an inhabited world has passed through successive planetary ages, the pre- and the post-planetary prince ages, the post-Adamic age, the post-magisterial sun age, and the post-bestowal sun age. And then is such a world made ready for the culminating evolutionary attainment, the settled status of light and life, by the ministry of the successive planetary missions of the Trinity Teacher Sons, with their ever-advancing revelations of divine truth and cosmic wisdom. In these endeavors, the teacher sons enjoy the assistance of the brilliant evening stars always, and the Melchizedek sometimes, in establishing the final planetary age. This era of light and life, inaugurated by the teacher sons at the conclusion of their final planetary mission, continues indefinitely on the inhabited worlds. Each advancing stage of settled status may be segregated by the judicial actions of the magisterial sons into a succession of dispensations. But all such judicial actions are purely technical, in no way modifying the course of planetary events. Only those planets which attain existence in the main circuits of the super universe are assured of continuous survival. But as far as we know, these worlds settled in light and life are destined to go on throughout the eternal ages of all future time. There are seven stages in the unfoldment of the era of light and life on an evolutionary world. And in this connection, it should be noted that the worlds of the spirit-fused mortals evolve along lines identical with those of the Adjuster Fusion series. These seven stages of light and life are: 1, the first or planetary stage; 2, the second or system stage; 3, the third or constellation stage; 4, the fourth or local universe stage; 5, the fifth or minor sector stage; 6, the sixth or major sector stage; 7, the seventh or super universe stage. At the conclusion of this narrative, these stages of advancing development are described as they relate to the universe organization. But the planetary values of any stage may be attained by any world quite independent of the development of other worlds or of the superplanetary levels of universe administration. Are you there? Hello?
We're here in stunned silence.
Yes. We were.
I'm like, boy, I hope I wasn't reading to the ethers. Because that didn't happen.
It was
Well, Well, there's several things that stick out about this section, but, you know, the fact that, well, I don't know, I can't find it now, but go ahead. Does anybody have a thought about this one? There's just so much here.
Yeah, there really is.
Well, I think
lot.
It's interesting that these, you know, that these stages are described as stages in the unfoldment of the era of light and life on an evolutionary world. But yet, once we get into this list, we begin to see the relation of an individual world to its next higher and higher levels in the universe administration.
That's
so
true,
it seems that
too.
The implication is, like in number four, when the entire local universe reaches light and life, then our planet's relationship to that is going to, you know, be upstepped or changed or expanded or something, because it'll be held in common with the entire local universe, you know, just like in all the other stages. So I'm not sure what that means or what that looks like, but it's kind of intriguing to contemplate that the you know, these higher levels of universe achievement of light and life are going to reflect back and have an impact on our on the individual world's prior achievement of light and life, but then growing somehow in relation to these higher levels of that same achievement. What that would
really
mean
struck me.
Yeah, communications or cultural, you know, it could be that, you know, the cultural achievements of these higher levels will, you know, become part of our experience in some way, you know, almost leading toward, you know, what they say about the Supreme, you know, when, this,
mm-hmm.
when the Supreme is finally achieved, then it's like everyone gets it all at once, right? So all of this relates very directly to the Supreme, and in some ways, maybe, you know, in anticipation of that final stage, you know, the emergence of the Supreme. But I'd never noticed before that they list these stages so directly in association with these ascending administrative levels.
Well, and they're talking about, obviously, the ascension here. And so what struck me about that, because we will ascend through all of these levels, but what struck me, I guess, was here we are, a planet, and we're going through these levels. So what are they saying? Are they saying that they would reveal these various levels at these stages?
No. No, they're not saying that.
Well, they've revealed them right here.
We're already, it's already revealed. It's more a matter of relating us to that level of administration, that there's parity. We have achieved something that is actually functioning at that level, and so there's new ways that we can be associated with that level. So that's kind of interesting when we read it later toward the end of this paper, where they talk about those stages as they relate to the actual levels. It is, you know, interesting to go ahead and make a comparison as to what kinds of things are being done. For instance, one of the things that they talk about in that second or system stage that we'll get to is the whole culture is, they don't say obsessed, but it sounds like they are. The whole culture of the world is busy studying and they use this word, the protean concept of the creator sons, okay? In other words, they're studying the first level of God, the sevenfold. And protean is a very interesting word because it means literally ever-shifting. And that's intriguing. So in other words, we're going to start learning about creator sons in ways that we haven't suspected they could be. Right now, we basically filter all our knowledge of creator sons through our knowledge of one, our own creator son, Michael of Nevadon, who lived here as Jesus of Nazareth, and have been given only anecdotal references to some of what
some of those other creator sons have done, which are very few and far between, which really don't tell us too much about them. But perhaps there's some way in which we're learning about them at that state. But the idea is that at these various stages, different things are happening. They say, you know, I have witnessed on a world long settled in the age of seventh stage of light and life, the Abaddonters coming down from Uversa and teaching the super universe language to the mortals of that realm. Well, that's, they're indicating something there about teaching not just language, but a sophisticated language and sophisticated way of being able to think about reality by presenting those concepts. There must be knowledge of the concepts in order to be able to teach the language. That's quite remarkable.
Yeah.
Yeah, I kind of, the image, I kind of agree with you, Andrea. The image is, you know, we have this, the Rancho book, this revelation, which talks to us about all these things. So we can sort of imagine them in our creative imagination. But we're certainly not experiencing any of these things. We talk about this quite a bit, that, you know, so much of what the book describes is way beyond what we can actually experience here on this world. And the implication of what you're saying, Andre, and I think you're correct, is that, you know, in these, it seems like it's got to be far distant ages for our world, when people are living 400 or 500 year lifespans, and you've got all this connection with the universe facilities and methodologies and beings, that it's more than just reading about these things. You're beginning to actually have encounters with some of these things that foreshadow the ascension all the way up and become integrated with those realities, which is, that's pretty astonishing, really, to think about.
Yeah.
And it's so far away from our reality that it remains pretty speculative.
Yeah.
But still the promise is there that that's what happens in the far reaches of advancement on a normal world. That's pretty astonishing, you know. It's almost like we get to practice some of the things that we would be doing up at the constellation and local universe and minor and major sector levels. We get to practice some of that and engage with some of those beings in anticipation of actually going there in these long lives that we would live.
Yeah,
that's such a good point.
Hence the ability to skip some of those levels later on in the evolution of a planet long settled in light and life. More and more of those individuals rise by the secondary modified order of ascension at a higher level, you know, skipping what they've already learned and eventually fusing and maybe making it all the way to the Salvington training worlds and Salvington itself eventually, and then coming back, you know, to experience some of those lesser realities that they have had to skip by, because even though they've learned those lessons, the experience is still important.
Yeah, I think that's such an important thing to keep in mind, that the experience is still important. That blessed, that holy generation, you know, still has to. And perhaps the way they experience it is not like living the material life and feeling it so viscerally while you're on the ground. But when you've evolved to that level where you're so engaged with love and your heart, and you're sent back as on a mission to a world that's struggling, it would be a different kind of experience to see how they struggle, to love them so much, and to see how they struggle, and you know, to want to help them so badly, you know, and to be constrained by you know, all the things that they're constrained by. The fact that we can't hear them speaking to us, or we don't know fully what it is they're trying to do. You know, we can't see them working, though they are. You know, so that would be a different type of experience for sure. I kind of try to put myself in their place a lot and sympathize with what they go through. You know, those high-level teachers who come down to help us.
What's occurring to me a little bit is, as you're speaking, Paula, and just trying to get a sense of the magnitude of these contrasts between, let's say, our experience and the experience of a mortal that is born on an advanced world and life and life. What's a little helpful for me is I try and imagine one of my brothers or sisters that would have been born back, you know, let's say pre-planetary prince, or around the time of the planetary prince, that lived in a very primitive society where their struggle for existence was pretty basic. And they were just beginning, and they had primitive awe and superstition, you know, about the elements, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And their worldview and what they experienced, and when they would die, they would go on to those initial mansion worlds, and they would probably spend a fair bit more time on the initial mansion worlds than we might. Because we come, let's say, those of us who read this book, with so much more context and have lived our lives with that context in terms of why we function and why we're here and our relationship with God and the possibilities and just the things we're talking about today, that is such a big difference between where we are and where someone who had grown up in those circumstances would be, that you could see where they would need to do a lot of catching up in the early mansion worlds, so we might skip lightly or come back and do stuff. It would be different. And that's just the early stages of the ascension life, that discrepancy would show up. But if you project it on out between where we are and where someone in a 500-year lifespan growing up in the kind of culture they're describing in this paper, you begin to see, okay, I think how all that, you can see how all that fits together in the bigger picture.
You know what occurs to me too is as we look at the situation from their point of view, say if they could come back, and you know, perhaps many of them are here right now, even from these other worlds who were settled in light and life, and they ascended, and then they've come back to serve on planets just like this in various ways. And if we could see the world through their eyes, perhaps it's not unlike us looking at a primitive society right now existing on this world, even as we speak, at the mercy of some brutal dictator, you know, at the mercy of ignorance and fear and superstition and violence and animal tendencies. And we say to ourselves, as people living in a more liberated and enlightened society, gosh, I'm glad I don't have to deal with that. I learn a lot. It makes me grateful for my situation in life. It makes me grateful that, you know, and if you were from a planet settled in light and life and you came back and saw what was going on this world, you'd probably have that experience of say, wow, I'm so grateful that I didn't have to go through all of this. You know, you still say, how can I help?
I got, you know, well, I got left out of that whole challenging and thrilling period of evolution, too. I mean, there's different ways of looking at that. You know, it's just like the angels, they don't always want to serve in the most difficult circumstances because those are the most interesting in a way.
Well, I guess that's
so
true.
Yeah, I mean,
yeah.
It cuts both
ways.
We're
living a day today that is, you know, emblematic of that disparity in culture that allows, you know, allows the world to experience some horrific things and disallows the world from being able to move forward without handling certain kinds of realities. you know, this live broadcast is occurring on Saturday, September 11th, 2021, 20 years to the day after the attack on the Twin Towers by various members of Al-Qaeda. And we look at this day and see that a culture that was fomenting, and by the culture I mean a subculture of, you know, a radicalized Islamic cell, was able to motivate individuals to try to destroy something they didn't fully understand.
Mm-hmm.
And we can say that definitively. You know, if you understood what was here, you wouldn't really want to destroy it, if you understood it completely. On the other hand, we don't understand entirely the filter that they were looking through to be able to see that. But clearly, I mean, when we were reading those various, you know, the nutrition epic and all of those epics, we have all of those epics, the lower ones, here. We're barely into the fourth one of moving toward greater quality of thinking and what that one was talking about. But with unenlightened cultures that are teaching fundamentalist ideologies and fomenting hate, there are still all kinds of things that could drag us back. There were other things planned that day that we didn't get to experience because some of those other things were thwarted. We only know of one of them, but there were other buildings that were planned to be attacked, and there were other things that were planned to be done down the road.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, that's exemplary of this culture being spread out among so many different levels.
Yes, exactly.
And I mean, to hear,
and that's one of our challenges.
I was listening to the live broadcast this morning from New York City of, you know, the reading of the names,
mm-hmm.
and the heart-wrenching aspect of the loss. I mean, just one loss, just one person gone is heart-wrenching. You know, 2,983 people in one fell swoop.
Mm-hmm.
And all the lives that have changed and the PTSD and everything else that has ensued from that still persists today. You know, a generation was changed and that had ripple effects throughout our entire society. We changed the way we get on an airplane. We changed so many other things about how we secure this country. And it affected us deeply, had ramifications all the way through. So there's no moving forward in one aspect of your culture without dealing with the other aspects of culture on the planet.
Well, it's sort of in relation to that, Andre. I mean, I imagine, you know, here we are looking back 20 years. What if we were 20,000 years in the future in one of these ages of light and life, just to pick a speculative time? Probably quite inaccurate. And we were looking back, and we were in a context where there was one world government, where science had been perfected. These are the things they describe in these later ages of light and life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where people live 500 years, where science was perfected to its culmination and was pervasive as a force, where education was universal, where religion was universal, where there was one race. And they were looking back, you know, at this stage, and they were saying, my God, you know, this pandemic and these environmental disasters that were beginning to manifest and grew increasingly dire for the human race, and et cetera, et cetera. And they were splintered, and they had no government, and atheism was running rampant. They would look back at the conditions we were in and they would roll their eyes probably at what we have, what we are having to deal with, you know, and the trauma it's caused, and the individual lives that were disrupted and cut short, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, just look at this pandemic for one thing, you know, and what it's done. And we're in the middle of it. We still don't know where it's going to go and how it may eventually culminate. And we're dealing with the inefficiency of our social, political, economic structures for dealing with any of this in a coordinated fashion. The environmental issues, I mean, which are vast, you know, and the coordination that's required. So, you know, they're going to look back at our times and in astonishment at what we were dealing with, I'm sure.
So that begs a question. Here's a question for you guys. We know that the Oranger book teaches the value of a sorrowful experience, right? A sorrowful experience. And the value of tribulation and, you know, that we only learn wisdom through these challenging things. But would you say that there are some experiences on this world that are just too traumatic, that they have no value because they traumatize humans so badly that they really can't overcome that trauma? And it's just too much. Do you think there are experiences like that on this world?
That's a profound question, Paula.
I don't know that there's anything that can't be overcome, but there are some things that most people will not overcome. You know, the pandemic of child sexual abuse in our culture and throughout the world is rampant and has implications that hold back our culture, frankly. I mean, it's hard to have a culture where you have God as a parental figure when you have parental figures that very often are part of child sexual abuse. That's just one aspect.
Yeah, one thing, but a good example.
Just trying to focus on your question, Paula. I mean, I try to think of an actual person, right? Let's say who experienced what Andre's talking about or other horrendous things, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We could go on and on with an endless list of the terrible things that people go through in this life. And what I come back to is if the person, because the ability to reach out and form a connection with God inwardly is there regardless of whatever has happened in a person's life. Whether they do it or not, I don't know. But the capacity to do it in a normal-minded human being is there. And what I have to hold on to is that if a person will do that, no matter how meager their connection, but they hope and they aspire and they ask for help and their sincere heart, and no matter how overcome they are and overwhelmed, and even if they give up at points, I have to believe that they're reconstituted in the next life and given the opportunity and the help and the support and the ministry, the restorative, rehabilitative ministry, especially on those first two mansion worlds, you know, where the first is devoted to restoration of woundedness or healing woundedness related to physical things and then intellectual and psychological on the second. I have to believe they may spend quite a bit of time on those worlds, but I have to believe what the book tells me is that if they aspire and hope for connection and resolution of these things, no matter how bad their trauma, they will be given the opportunity. So beyond that, I think it's utterly beyond our capacity to discern what's going on within a human being. But anyways, those are things that occur to me in response to your question. It's a very deep question.
Well, and, you know, it was your comment about 20,000 years from now, when our children's children's children look back on what we were going through, you know, and what will it take, what occurs to me is in that 20,000 years for us collectively to get over what we've done to each other, you know, and to forgive each other along the way. And, you know, I think we always hope against hope, and Chuck mentioned this earlier, that some people go, well, all we have to do is this and then we'll be there, you know. And I think about all the things we'll have to do to get there, and I think, wow, that's going to take some time. But I also think about their statement that, you know, we won't settle down complacently for 1,000 years, and I think I was telling you guys a couple weeks ago, but the good news is we will settle down complacently. And it's in the settling down, I think, when you finally settle into certain realities and you start to get used to that, and you know, obviously war has become socially bankrupt, right, incapable of producing anything good, right? They say that. So we got to lose war. And if we could go for a certain amount of time without it, then we might begin to shift and focus on, you know, and that'll be the beginning of one step toward away from our obsession with darkness and death and towards an obsession of light and life, right? Being focused on light and life. When I say obsession, that's what I mean. If we could just focus on that and not always be defending ourselves or worried about, you know, the specter that hangs over our head oftentimes, or, you know, unconsciously stresses people out. Even, you know, a lot of our fathers came back from World War II with such bad PTSD that they became alcoholics and abusive. You know, and that we were talking about the ripple effect. So it's just interesting to think what it's going to take to get to that 20,000 years down the road and be able to look back and even shudder and say, wow, I can't even believe that was our reality at one point, you know.
Well,
and Marvin,
don't
you
forget.
Go ahead, Chuck. No, go ahead.
I was going to say, but don't forget about the interregnum quote. I mean, it could be 20,000 years from now, we'll just be rebuilding and not even back to where we are now. I mean, there can be serious setbacks. I mean, they're warning us that that's possible. That,
right.
You know, when things happen too advanced too fast without spiritual wisdom insight, you know, there's the seeds of retrogression built in. So it's all, you know, it's dicey. I mean, we know we're going to get there eventually, but there may be some retrogressions along the way that we can't even anticipate at this point. So so that issue of worship wisdom, it comes up in that quote. That's, you know, I think that's where a lot of energy and focus could be applied, is to
that raises
what it is that we worship.
Right. True. Yeah. Or obsessed with.
But it also,
that can become our vision of destiny.
Yeah, but Chuck, your point raises the metacognitive question, is what is this revelation for? If we're forecasting an interregnum of 20,000 years as a possibility.
Well, I'm not forecasting it. Yeah.
Well, okay, but I mean, in a way.
I mean, I'm just saying it's possible.
By saying that, you have a conception of it. And by having a conception of it, you have some scenario that you're envisioning where we might move in that direction. And what I would just state to challenge that a little bit is, you know, they're not giving us a revelation for no reason. They obviously have faith in their revelations, or they wouldn't do them. And we have a revelation of Jesus of Nazareth that we're told, you know, will eventually succeed, implying it hasn't completely succeeded yet. But revelations don't fail. And Melchizedek's revelation didn't fail. The only ones that did, to some extent, are the ones where the leaders, you know, didn't follow through with what they were supposed to do. The question is, with this one, is this being put in our hands because they think we're going to fail, or because they think we're going to succeed?
Hmm.
Well, like a good parent, you know, always want to warn your kids of the dangers.
Right.
Have
and
a
they
good
do.
Time, but watch out.
And they do warn us in many ways.
And
they give us pretty stark
warnings. Some of
these
warnings are pretty sobering. So,
yes, they are.
Part of the, all part of the same picture. That's all.
Well, but, you know,
Chuck,
there's these sorry, go ahead, Paul.
No, go ahead.
After you.
I was just going to say, when Chuck said about the interregnum, I chuckled, not because the interregnum is funny, but I heard my mom in the back of my head saying, well, you could have gone all day and not said that. But, you know, that is, you're right, Chuck. It is a sobering warning that they give us. It's one of them. There's many, actually, in the book, taken as a whole. There's quite a few. And they're,
well, you know,
they have value.
Establishmentarianism out of the way and onomatopoeia as well. That way, those words couldn't have been said today either. But
so
true.
So just to go back to your comment, Paul, about we'll not settle down complacently for a millennium. No, that's almost predictive, you know. And let's keep in mind these relatives have seen many ages unfold on countless worlds. So they have the backlog of tremendous universe experience. And so when they say, you know, you're in for a time of great turbulence and things are accelerating rapidly, and they say, the implication is that at the end of 1,000 years of all of that turbulence, they will settle down and things will be reconfigured on some level. And so what you're saying, Andre, is this revelation does have a role to play in all of that. And the angels are hard at work trying to make things happen in this next 1,000 years that are consistent with what they're showing us in this revelation. So, I mean, that's important to keep in mind. You know, there's an awful lot of work going on in the background, and our work and our ministry, you know, piecemeal as it is and a little bit here and there as it is, as best we can as it is a part of that. But there's something much larger being prosecuted here.
Without a doubt.
And the interregnum, you know, that doesn't necessarily mean total disaster and regression to caveman times, Chuck. You know, I mean, that's a regression, you know, but I don't think that's more science fiction stuff. I don't think that's, you know, it's like dystopian societies. I think that's more our common culture. I don't think that's reality, what would happen. But I frankly think that this thing we're dealing with you know, the pandemic is a sort of falling back to some extent and a shocking lesson that is trying to teach us some things. And whether we'll learn them or not, you know, who knows?
We're faced with, you know, I mean, I used to hang out with New Agers a lot because – ironically, the New Age were the people who engaged in New Age teachings and went to New Age gatherings were the ones most interested in or most open to, let's put it that way, the Urantia book and what it has to say. And they had a saying throughout the whole 90s and even beyond that, that rent's coming due on the planet. And, you know, there's so much truth to that, that is a lesson humanity has to learn, you know. You have to take care of your place, you know, mother, and it is, to me, it is, mother provides place, mother is place. We call it Mother Nature, we call it Mother Earth. It is our place. And we have to take care of it. We have to think about it. And sad that the red man didn't have a chance to give that to us, because they would have had we embraced it, had the East not been so haughty and sure of itself and calling the Western cultures savage when it conquered the Americas. And, you know, the red man probably would have taught us to love our mother and care for our place. and make sure that our place is sustainable going forward, and that how important that is. But we didn't learn that lesson. Clearly, we didn't learn it. And, if there's an interregnum, maybe that's what it is. The interregnum is, okay, well, you've kind of soiled your own nest here. And now those things that you took for granted that the place abundantly provided for you are not so abundant anymore. And now you have to overcome that lack in order to even get back to where you were.
Yeah. Yeah, I was just going to say, too, we have to be careful not to blame ourselves too much for everything that goes wrong on this world, because unlike normal worlds, this is not a sinless sphere. they refer to normal worlds as sinless spheres. And the presence of sin implies deliberate wrongdoing, going deliberately against God, going deliberately against evolution and all of that. So we have to contend with that on this world, not to blame ourselves, but to be wary and aware, wise as serpents. I mean, in a normal world, the influence of the Mother Spirit and the Holy Spirit and the coming of the Spirit of Truth and the gift of thought adjusters, all those things work together to gradually, progressively, not that there aren't difficulties and ups and downs, but, gradually there's a move forward where one generation can build on the last and things slowly evolve in the directions they talk about. But on a world where sin is present, there can be influences coming in from left field you wouldn't even expect. Deliberate efforts to undermine the good things on this world. So that's where this whole interregnum thing, I think, has to be kind of taken seriously, not to blame ourselves so much, but to be wary of that danger so that we're constantly working to uplift our spiritual awareness and the quality of our worship.
That's our blind side, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's our blind side. We don't know what we don't know. That's the problem. And so we often have big blind spots as we move forward. And, Andre pointed out 9/11, and that was a huge one. that one was like getting clouded from behind, and nobody expected it. And it changed the course of our history, as Americans at least, and the world. The whole world grieved that happening. But it just kind of came out from left field and hit us all unaware.
Well,
we were off guard.
There was a podcast, interestingly, entitled similar to what you just said, Blind Spot, that was talking about the fact that, it really didn't come out of left field entirely. We had been watching some things and trying to deal with some things that we were seeing with Al Qaeda and Bin Laden, and after all, let's remember, the CIA funded the Mujahideen and all of that, right? We started that ball in motion because it suited our purposes in the 80s in defeating the presence of the Soviets in Afghanistan at that time. And, after that, we just let it run amok. But there were those that were paying attention. Unfortunately, it wasn't all of the society that was paying attention. There were a lot of people that let a lot of things go by that allowed that incident to take place. A lot of things were ignored or missed that we could have been paying attention to. And that's part of it. That's what, to me, part of what the revelation does is it makes us aware of what we ought to be paying attention to. I was going to miss this webcast today in order to go to a meeting of a Urantia book reader who was calling together a group of community members that had an interest in a statesmanship school, right?
That is taking the concepts of the Revelation and saying, that's talked about. What might that look like? What might that do? So there are other things. There are so many other things people discuss all the time. You know, it would be a great service. You don't understand what it might do for the culture moving forward. But, you know, hospice care and giving people a view of the afterlife where they have it in mind as something not to be dreaded at worst, you know, and maybe something to look forward to at best, would have a positive influence on the culture. Mm. And on. You guys can mention, I'm sure, dozens of things that would fit that category.
That's a good point. I didn't know about this. What is that called, Andre, the meeting or the grouping, the gathering you were talking about?
You're just calling a bunch of people together for a statesmanship school, and it was largely community members. It wasn't your ranchers. I was, as far as I know, myself, maybe there's somebody else, but it was the only other Urantia book reader that he was calling, you know, toward this thing.
Oh, okay.
So, but the point is, there are all kinds of things like this that we could do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, helping with reading. You know, if we call each other readers, Frank Laubach, who was sort of the brother of Lawrence of the 20th century, who practiced the presence of God and came up with the game of minutes, you know, was a champion of world literacy and started such a program both here in America and in his Chinese missionary work. And again, the more we bring God into our life, the more likely we are to put ourselves in places to be of service in one way or another.
Mm-hmm.
What's the next right thing for each of us to do?
Right.
Indeed. I wonder if
sometimes the fog
lives.
Yeah, sure.
I was wondering if you could go back to what we read for a second. There's an interesting detail in that first paragraph that I think maybe is worthy of just a little more attention, where they say that, you know, they talk about how the Trinity teach her sons, Tom, to prepare the planet for the era of light and life, you know, their successive missions. And they point out that in these endeavors, the teacher sons enjoy the assistance of the brilliant evening stars, always. So brilliant evening stars are always come in association with the Trinity teacher sons. So I was looking over here where they talk about the brilliant evening stars. They're described in paper 37, section 2, which we don't need to read, but they point out that they're brought into existence by the creator son and the creative spirit. So they're kind of like angelic beings, but their origin includes the creator son, whereas, you know, the seraphim are created exclusively by the creator spirit. But these brilliant evening stars, well, some of them are created that way, and then others...
Some of them are ascendant,
Right, some of them are ascendant, so there's two different types. But I thought I'd skip down here. There are a couple of interesting paragraphs that might just add a little bit of context to what we're reading. I'll just read a couple of paragraphs. Well, here's one paragraph that's super interesting, I think. This is in that same section, 37-5, the fifth paragraph of section 2, where they say that both types of brilliant evening stars are easily visible to Urantia personalities and certain types of supermortal material beings. And then they say the creative beings of this interesting and versatile order possess a spirit force which can be manifested independently of their personal presence.
Wow.
So that just by itself is super intriguing. But then a couple of paragraphs down, let's see. Okay, in the eighth paragraph, then they go on to explain that one of the high duties of the evening stars is to accompany the Avonal Bestowal Sons on their planetary missions, even as Gabriel accompanied Michael on his Urantia Bestowal. So Gabriel accompanied Michael, but these brilliant evening stars were to serve the same purpose with the Avonal Sons. The two attending super angels are the ranking personalities of such missions, serving as commanders of the archangels and all others assigned to these undertakings. It is the senior of these super angel commanders who, at the significant time and age, bids the Avonal Son to be about your brother's business. Interesting. You know, Michael, Jesus talked about, oh, I'm going to be about my father's business. But in the case of the Avonals, they go about their brother's business. And then they say in the next paragraph, this is paragraph 9, similar pairs of these super angels are assigned to the planetary core of the Trinity Teacher Sons that functions to establish the bestowal or dawning spiritual age on an inhabited world, which is what we were just reading about. And then they say, on such assignments, the evening stars serve as liaisons between the mortals of the realm and the invisible core of Teacher Sons. So that explains their function, why they always accompany the Teacher Sons, because they serve in that all-important liaison role. And may even be, well, I don't know, at that time, maybe there's enough Urantia development, even in the mortal races, that they could begin to see them. So I don't know. That's just a guess. But they sound like a very intriguing order. But that their ability to serve as a liaison between the Teacher Sons, which I think, are they of, Trinity. They're of paradise origin, right? So they're very high beings. So there needs to be kind of a bridge. And these evening stars perform that function.
So, you know, in that in that section, Chuck, and they kind of spell out to the evolution from the early times of primitive man, such an inhabited world has passed through successive planetary ages, the pre and the post-planetary prince ages, the post-Adamic age, the post-magisterial sun age, and the post-bestowal sun age. And then is such a world ready for the culminating evolutionary attainment, the settled status of light and life, by the ministry of the successive planetary missions of the Trinity Teacher Sons with their ever-advancing revelations of divine truth and cosmic wisdom, which is why one of the reasons I asked, do you think in part that they reveal these different levels to us as they go on? Because there's another place in the book where they say that, you know, to be given this much knowledge is at one time is rather unprecedented. But then again, you look at this and you say, okay, so we're way out of sync here because we haven't passed through any of these ages, actually.
So we've already had a bestowal son. We've already had a bestowal son.
Right.
Which is crazy.
Which
in
is
a way.
Crazy.
I mean,
in a way, it is.
That
and
wouldn't normally
like,
occur until much later in the planet's development.
You know, sometimes as I look at you know, I like to think of life in our universe as like a great card game, equal elements of skill and chance, you know. And we're talking about beings that are highly skilled, right? But there's always the element of chance, too. And there's always the aspect of free will.
And somebody in the game who likes to cheat.
Well, right. You know, who knew, you know, on these worlds that you pointed out where they've, you know, they've come in with unmitigated selfishness and unbridled self-liberty and just, well, we'll do whatever we want. God doesn't exist anyway. This is all a hoax. So, you know, you might as well, here you go again. You might as well live to the utmost. You only get to go around once in life, right? All of these old sayings that we tell each other that are so hopeless and nihilistic. I don't know how else to describe it. But, you know, in context, to look at our world and the way it's out of step, then it makes you wonder what could happen here. And I get the sense that the universe, you know, back to the skill and chance idea, things happen and they recalibrate often. And going back to your comment, Andre, about protein, you know, being able to recalibrate, being able to change frequently or easily. So, you know, you just have to wonder how that plays into our, you know, progress. How does this play in the fact that we've already had a bestowal son and we haven't gone through any of these ages and these things that these teachers would have given us abundantly over a great period of time didn't happen. Those foundations were not built very solidly. It's
not at
intriguing
all. I mean, almost
the
not
whole
at all.
Thing is intriguing.
Yeah,
almost not at all. And the fact that we have all of the stages.
Some foundation, you know.
Right.
Otherwise, Jesus would have had nothing.
Right. He would have had nothing. And even that, even Melchizedek doing that, was probably largely as a result of Jesus announcing that he's going to come here. It's like, okay,
sure.
Recalibrate. Now we have to do something to set the stage for this so that it has the best chance of success. And time really is on their side. That's the thing we don't see, I think, often as humans. We don't see how much time is on their side and how they're playing the long game, totally playing the long game.
Well, to your earlier point as well, you know, your earlier point regarding the idea of the nihilistic thinking and the idea, you know, war, this will never change. You know, this will never change. And then ever and anon, you have leaders grow up in different generations that say, no, this, not only will this change, this has to change. And so
right.
You get a Malala arising even after she's been shot, right?
Yeah.
Or
right.
Or you get a Greta Thunberg, who is an Asperger's child, who is, you know, leading the world and inspiring the world for climate change. My goodness. You know, these are unlikely leaders. And
right.
Here they're arising, but they're gaining a following also, and unbeknownst to the older generation, the younger generation is thinking much differently. They're thinking, no, this is untenable. It's untenable to have, you know, women have this lack of rights. It's untenable for us to be completely disregardful of the climate and the planet the way we've been doing. And you could put any number of other things in this category. Will we get such a leader rise up about the friction between nations? Well, you do get those kinds of things, and sometimes also they don't get to rise up because they're incarcerated. You have a Navalny in Russia, or you have the journalist that was taken off of a plane that was,
right,
you know, from Belarus and all of that.
Right.
So you have all these possibilities, and it's a matter of whether or not people adequately get behind them, whether people adequately rise to the occasion.
But they
do
inspire. Nelson Mandela inspired a whole generation, right, and beyond. So they kind of stand as a punctuation in history where somebody rose up and said something that needed to be said or did something that needed to be done. And even if that's not embraced in that person's lifetime, often it's embraced going down the road, and it's astonishing, really. And those are the kinds of things that give you great hope, right? you'd see young people. You know, I know that you guys all, you look at your children, how beautiful they are, how dedicated they are. And I know all of you have beautiful, dedicated children. And they're bright and they're engaged and they're not prejudiced and they're not, you know, they're so tuned into humanity and they want so to make a difference in the world, right? Mm-hmm. And you think, oh, man, this gives me so much hope. This makes me happy to think that, you know, all of these young people I'm meeting are such quality people. They mean so well, and they are living it. They're not just talking about it. They're doing it, and they mean it. You know, you offered Malala and Greta Thunberg, and, you know, there's you know, even if you disagree. And, you know, certainly there's plenty of people who would disagree with both of them, either of them. There are plenty who do agree and who get it. You know, it takes courage to stand up and say something that may not be very popular right now. You know, and it got Malala shot. Mm-hmm. But like she said, you know, you can shoot a body, but you can't shoot a dream. And that's, you know, John Lennon saying, Imagine we could do this, because if we can't imagine it, then we won't be able to achieve it. But we have to be able to imagine it and believe that it's possible, know that it's possible, and that we are very clever and resourceful and able to adapt. We've done it for centuries, and that's the hope of humanity. And why you can believe that we will reach light and life, or we will settle down complacently at some point, put an end to war. All of these wonderful things we hope for are, you know, we have evidence of them even now.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we do.
Even though the task is daunting, it seems daunting. But it's like my old boss Mo used to say, you eat an elephant one bite at a time.
Oh, for goodness sake, he said that? Where did he
always
hear that?
Yeah. it always seems like our tasks are daunting, and so that was one of Mo's favorite sayings. Well, Paula, you eat an elephant one bite at a time, so just get busy and take a bite and work on that and then go to the next bite, you know. And how we achieve great things is in the day-to-day doing, just consistently, faithfully doing, you know, little things. Mother Teresa is another person who said it a different way, you know. It's not so important to do great things as to do little things with great love.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Well, that's, you know, I'm glad we went down this. We only read one section, and I don't think we have time to read the Morontia Temple, but I'm glad we spent time on that, and especially 9/11, to commemorate the day and the lessons learned, perhaps, and even if we just only scratch the surface on some of the challenges, you know, we might face getting to light in life. I think, you know, we will get there. Of that, I'm sure. And, you know, I don't know if I've ever told you guys this, but I have petitioned the universe officially that on the day that we are ushered into light and life, that there be one great gigantic planetary celebration, and that all of the beings that have participated in that adventure, whether they were humans, and this is the planet of their nativity, or whether they were angels, or whether they were Melchizedeks, or mighty messengers, student visitors, whatever they were, if they participated in the grand culmination of Urantia making it to light and life, that we have one big party on the planet, and we all get to come back and celebrate and light that candle.
That'd be nice. Yeah.
What do you think?
Do you guys think we're going to be there together?
Wouldn't that be awesome?
I think so.
I mean,
you know,
I think
that
would
be
great.
We'll all be in Havana. You know, I don't know that we can get here for that. I don't think it's going to be that long in the future. Or we may not even be in Havana. We may be just up around, you know, Salvington or something. Maybe they will let us back. I don't know. That's a good point.
Well,
hard to know the timeline.
I put it out there, but as in all things, not my will.
No,
but
you might
their
be right.
Infinite
I
and glorious wisdom.
That,
and of course it would be a matter of whosoever will let him come. You know, they wouldn't make you do it if you didn't want to, but maybe they could facilitate you coming for that celebration. And I just think it would be a tribute,
well,
a great
Michael
tribute
is
to
almost
the
certain
persistence.
To be here, right? You know,
yeah,
for that.
True.
So
yeah,
maybe.
Good point.
Yeah, maybe there'll be a coming back for that. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't think that'll be a second coming either.
No.
I think that'll be subsequent to second coming. So.
Well, that's, you know, what we're doing, what we've engaged in is a bit of universe romancing, and that feels good to me, especially on such a sad anniversary for our country. But
well,
it
maybe
isn't
a
the
quick
only
round robin would be to say on this sad anniversary, you know, given how fraught and spread out we are, what would be the one thing that you think we need to most work on in our culture, you know, what would be a good next step? And per what your Mother Teresa comment, a small step with great love that could be taken in the right direction. You know, I've already mentioned the statesmanship schools, you know, would be one, you know, maybe a smaller step would be just trying to increase a group that you don't understand, try to gain some understanding for that group.
Absolutely.
Worship wisdom is something we could all work on and contribute to.
Good.
So define that
the
again
antidote,
for us.
Which is the antidote for the potential for the interregnum. So that's what I take away from that paragraph is that, okay, that's we've been given a task here pretty clearly.
Yeah.
And there's hope and promise in that. That's a positive realization.
Do you think, Chuck, do you think that means being worshipful in your decisions?
Sure, yeah.
I mean, you know, approaching, you know, your problems worshipfully, seeking the highest wisdom.
Yeah, that's part of it.
Yeah.
But it also includes growing in the wisdom, in our wisdom of what we worship.
Right.
So if we worship money, if we worship power, if we worship God, you know, you can clearly see the difference. But knowing God progressively, getting to know God better and better just through even this lifetime, will uplift our worship because we'll know, we'll have a better idea of the God that we're worshiping and the values that flow from that and the love and all of that, the expansive sense of possibility that flows from the worship of God, from truly worshiping God, you know, our Creator.
Right.
That fills
right.
us with the promise that, you know, is being offered for the taking. We just have to connect with the spiritual forces and tune our minds to those levels of possibility.
Right.
So that, I mean, that's kind of what I bring away from that worship wisdom idea. That's, you know, there's wisdom involved in our choice of what we worship. So to be constantly updating, upgrading. You know, it's interesting you think about the spirit of worship is the seventh adjective. Spirit of worship is the sixth adjective. So in that sense, our wisdom kind of governs our worship. Because it's
and our worship leads to our wisdom.
Well,
right.
Our wisdom grows,
yeah,
from that.
Yeah, Our worship leads to wisdom and growth, yeah.
Well,
yeah.
You know, I just think every act of love, every act where we care about another human being, think
right.
loving thoughts, pray for another human being, is a forward step.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah. So,
any
you know,
expression of love.
Important,
yeah.
Important not to discount the small everyday experiences we have, and that those are genuine
right.
contributions.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
To love,
and that,
to fully love the people you love, to fully honor and love the people you actually love, the people in your life, the people that are important to you, you know, to hold them up and you know, support them as best you can. And I think, mm-hmm. obviously, I mean, there's so many, you know, maybe low-hanging fruit that we could go for right now on this planet. And one of it is, you know, equality, feminine equality, to uplift women to a place where, you know, they feel they really matter. They have a voice and a choice in this world. It's really important. Because I think that feminine voice has been drowned out for so long. And it's so important. We're given two sexes for a reason, and they're, you know, each sex brings something to the table that's invaluable that we can't do without. And so to honor
complementary.
That feminine wisdom, yeah,
there's a complementary dynamic there,
right?
That has not been fully explored, I don't think.
Oh no, not even close.
You know, there's this beautiful paragraphs in the Marriage and Family Life papers where they talk about the ideals of, you know, men and women working together.
Right.
They say it can be personally antagonistic, but yeah, at the same time, it creates potentials that can't be created any other way. I mean, there's certain things men can do by themselves. There's certain things women can do by themselves. But what can be done by men and women working together is something that neither can do apart.
Right.
There's
right.
a whole additional realm of possibility that follows from fulfilling the potentials of a complementary dynamic. And that's, I think, what we're really called to explore. So that means honoring women, honoring men.
Yes,
you know,
absolutely.
But also
cool.
honoring the partnership, the partners,
right.
the complemental partnership of men and women. That also needs
right.
to be celebrated and explored.
Okay. Yeah, and the potentials of family life, and that is the first,
all
you know, I think Andre
yeah.
some mentioned getting to know somebody you don't know, some group you don't know. Well, men and women are they're the primary
uh-huh.
group that doesn't understand each other, you know.
Yeah.
And
well,
I think
a
lot of the things we experience is that we experience that, you know, that liberal and conservative dynamics. They're kind of male and female dynamics in a way, and they're at odds with each
mm-hmm.
other. And so if we could
yeah.
heal that misunderstanding, then we could probably be
yeah.
on the way to healing a lot of other
well,
ones.
Well, one of the ways to heal that, as the book talks about, is the family council model.
Absolutely.
The family life.
Yeah.
Which, you know, I really like that. The idea of family
uphold
council.
Family life. Yeah.
Right.
Where everybody has a voice and a seat at the table.
It's all talk about what's going on, yeah.
Right.
So that gives creates an arena for the complementary differences function
right.
constructively. So I think that family council idea is something we can really put forward as a kind of a healing concept, you know, to address the, you know, gender issues that we're also familiar with.
Well, as always, we start to read this book and we go down a path and we come up with some great insights, I think, and cross-references. And that's why I love our study together. It's just really priceless to me, and I'm so thankful for all of you. And I'm thankful for our listeners, and thank you, Perry and Isadora and Arvilla and anybody listening on the podcast. We love you and appreciate you, and we have a grand time doing this, so thanks for listening. And we'll be back next week with the Marantxa Temple, and I'm sure we'll come up with some great insights about that. And
yeah,
also,
just looking at that.
You might get the Death of Translation.
Yeah, really interesting section.
Really interesting, yeah.
I'll miss studying that with you, but I'll be back in 2 weeks.
Okay, Andre. Well, we'll miss you as always, but when you're not here, any of us, it's a great dynamic.
Yeah, travel safe, Andre.
Yeah, absolutely. Love you guys. Till next week.
Love you too.
Until next week.
Love you guys.
Have a great week.
Bye for now.
Bye for now.
You've been listening to The Cosmic Citizen, a radio program focused primarily on the study and discussion of the Urantia Book and its teachings. The Urantia Book is a religious text that claims to be written by angels and other superhuman personalities. If you are a Urantia Book reader or a spiritual seeker looking for new truth, we hope and pray you have been nourished and edified by our ministry. Please remember that the views expressed on this program do not reflect the official views and opinions of any Urantia organizations. There is no official interpretation of the Urantia Book. So all opinions expressed on this program exclusively reflect the personal biases of the hosts, guests, and callers who participate in these discussions. And remember, only a brave person is willing honestly to admit and fearlessly to face what a sincere and logical mind discovers.